I'm Christian Scheller. Welcome to my podcast, an enthusiastic ramble through whatever has taken my interest the past week or so. Expect technology, games, history, travel, geekery, and as always, much, much more. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Chinchilla Squeaks News with me, Christian Scheller. I will think of some better names for all this in the long run. Still getting the news side of the podcast and the newsletter. Better names for all these things. Naming things is hard. Anyway, still getting them all back off the ground. But so all of that better planning can wait until later. I actually have a lot of things to tell you about. A lot of the projects that I've been working on and keep teasing have come to fruition in the past couple of weeks. But before I get to those, I will give a few of the interesting links I have come across from the past 2 weeks. But before all that, something's got to keep the lights on. Something's got to keep me in new microphones, because that's basically all I spend my money on. And I have a few words from some sponsors. And I am back. So I have a little bit of a mixture of computing history, of computing future, and a few other little geeky bits and pieces to get in. Where shall I begin? I think I will begin with, let's begin with probably what's been the biggest news item from the past couple of weeks. And I am referring to the Wired article, but of course it was reported widely. The rather fascinating case of the XZ backdoor mastermind. And, well, it was a piece of malicious code introduced to an open source library, but it was very much done by human social engineering. This was an open source contributor. Many people theorize that it was more than one person, probably sponsored by a particular government or two, shall we say, who gradually became better and better known within this project and made some contributions. And then after a couple of years, made the crucial contribution that allowed a backdoor into the project. And the project is a command line lossless data compressor, which may not sound like a tremendous thing, but it's used in lots of other projects, including secure connection libraries. So it's quite important in that way. And I think it's actually made me quite paranoid now, because I have a couple of much smaller projects, of course, that get some contributions. And now, previously, I generally just sort of looked at the code fairly quickly and test it a little bit and let it through. And I'm not really suggesting that anything that I have would ever really be able to introduce any kind of security issue. I don't know if it's really relevant to the projects I have, but it does make you think. You know, you just see a username. GitHub especially is not particularly strict or stringent on the way it enforces identity. A lot of the profile fields you see are very arbitrary. Like location, for example, you can put anything you like. It doesn't really ask for any sort of proof, apart from maybe like key signing or something, which gives you a certain authenticity, but only really about, saying an account is who they say they are, but that doesn't mean you know who they are. So I just found this such a fascinating way of exposing a vulnerability, how it doesn't always have to just be something very quick, like a hack. This was built up over time, and that someone or some people sat down and planned this whole timeline out, this whole operation out to make it happen, to lead to a certain end goal. And that's almost what is most fascinating about this. Obviously, things have been rolled back now. It actually took a Microsoft employee to notice that suddenly connection pings were a few milliseconds longer, and they dug in. That is incredibly hard to spot. So thank you very much to that person, because who knows what could have happened. I don't think the vulnerable code was there for that long. So, you know, the vulnerability gets introduced through human relationships, and it gets spotted and fixed by a human as well. And I think this is interesting in showing that there are many smart tools now emerging that claim, and I've had some of them on the show and my YouTube channel, that claim to help you spot these and spot the patterns in at a scale that a human can't do. And yet quite often those little really edge case ones are actually spotted by a human just kind of saying, that doesn't look quite right. And it's not really even something they're quite sure why. They just spot it and then take things further. So yeah, I found it interesting, an interesting story, and we'll see if it changes things. I don't know. Who knows? And in a similar kind of tale of open source not kind of going the way people expected or hoped, I was actually expected to see this more widely reported. I am checking the kind of the comments in the post to see if there's anything, any kind of corrections or anything like that, but it doesn't seem to be. This was from InfoWorld, but OpenTofu. I'm actually going to have some interviews coming up in the coming months with the team behind OpenTofu, with some of the team behind them that I got to speak to at KubeCon. But what is it? It is an open source, purely open source, licensed fork of Terraform after HashiCorp changed their licensing, and the community around it very quickly created this open source fork of it. And it's been going very, very well, actually. And that is some of the things that came across in the interview. This was announced after the interview, so I didn't really get a time to dig into it. But licensing is always one of these key things where you have to be very careful, because in a Terraform version, which, and the version was one of the first non-open versions, HashiCorp introduced a new feature. And that feature was a similar feature emerged in OpenTofu that looked almost identical, basically just changed the license name. Now, of course, sometimes things just happen, and sometimes code can just look the same if it's doing something that is very similar. And obviously it's, at, you know, to be blunt, at the moment, largely the same code base. So it's conceivable that there was no malice. It was just pure coincidence. But I think this proves that you have to be very, very careful when something like this happens, because you can, in theory, go and get inspiration from a fork that isn't open or isn't open completely. You know, sometimes the code is there, but the application of that code isn't open. And you have to be very, very careful with the way you are inspired. And this is also coming up, of course, in things like AI-assisted coding. You hit the autocomplete on a method, but the source material of that, I mean, largely they are in the public domain, but maybe they're not. Where did it come from? Maybe your code will be cracked open in the future and someone will say, hey, this looks suspiciously like something I wrote and I don't like this. You know, you have to be a little careful about this. And yeah, I haven't really seen any response from the OpenTofu community around this. It's a shame I didn't really get to ask them about it, but I possibly have a follow-up interview, so maybe it's something that I will get to ask them then. On the subject of coding, this is actually a video from Kari, K-A-R-I, an English young woman, judging by her videos, who does a lot of coding videos, but there's one particular one that grabbed my attention because it reminded me of my history, and also because actually this conversation came up today when someone very young said, how did people learn to code in the past? Did you go and ask a nerdy neighbor? And some of us older people in the room said, books, magazines. And so actually the first frame you see of this video is her with some of these magazines. You literally used to type these programs out from the magazine. No copying and pasting. You had to get everything correct. Generally, you didn't. And then you had to figure out what you got wrong and onwards from there. But I found it a really interesting video to see, you know, a younger person doing what we had to do. And of course, the comments are full of older people talking about remembering this and seeing a young person now having to go through this. And so it was a cool video. And yeah, nice to see the generations exchanging their experiences. Now, on the subject of, well, modern development, and one thing you could probably say about older development, the kind of development that Carrie was looking at, is that it had to be very lean, very small. Things had to fit on cassette tapes into very small memory, et cetera, et cetera. And as we have gone further, we just keep adding more and more because we have systems that can kind of cope with it. And a lot of this is feeding into the whole sustainability argument on development and computing at the moment. More news on that from me in a moment, actually. And I came across this post on on danlu.com. It's a very plain looking website, probably intentional. And they have an entire graph showing the kind of bloat that is now in web applications. And they compare mostly some Apple processors, M3 Max, M1 Pro, both fairly high-end, but then some other processors too. And seeing, there's a lot of green in the middle on the high-end processors, but actually seeing the size of some pages, compressed and uncompressed. So using their site as a comparison, it's very plain. It's 6 kilobytes, 18 kilobytes, 50 milliseconds. Pretty fast. One of the slowest, it's half a second. And then we go to one of the biggest offenders, let's see, Threads, the Threads website. 9.3 megabytes on the wire, 13 megabytes raw, 1.5 seconds on M3 Max. on slower processors, 28 seconds. On a very slow processor, 66 seconds to load. Actually triggers a fail on some other sites as well. Other offenders, Wix, I guess, Wix.com. I mean, that's a site builder, which is interesting. 7 megabytes on the wire, 21 megabytes raw. It actually fails on some old processors. And this is emulating what some people will have to use, and mobile devices especially. And why is this a problem? Doesn't everybody just have high performance? No, they don't. And and this, even if you can run it, there is this sustainability environment impact as well on things. You know, why make pages so damn heavy just because you can? And the argument is, of course, that many developers, well, they are developing on these high-end systems, so they don't notice. This has been something that's been argued many, many times, that you should test your pages on slow systems. And there are tools to help with this. And this really is quite a damning show. And actually, we should call out some of the better ones. Medium is very good, actually. It's pretty good. MyBB, PHBB, these are older tools. WordPress is quite good as well. Ghost. So actually, most of these are open source, interestingly. I think there's probably some reasons for this, that some of these open source tools are not loaded with tracking pixels and ads. Same for Medium. A lot of people criticize Medium, but it's not laden with ads. It's not how they make money. I think when you look at Threads, Twitter, Blue Sky, also microblogging platforms, they're all heavy with ads, which is usually some of the biggest weight that gets added to these pages. But super interesting. danlu.com, you will find it there. I have to see what else they do, because I think I just came across this through something else. And it's interesting. I sort of like to remind these sort of things that remind people that you really should test on lower-end machines as well, because a vast majority of your users are probably actually using those. Now, this is something on MIT Technology Review. It's a subscriber-only story, which I actually am. So you may have to wait a little while to read it. But it was something around Adobe's approach to AI tools, and specifically Firefly, and how their approach has been much more creator and copyright friendly to their AI models, unlike some of the others, which are a little bit more draconian in terms of just gobbling up data to feed themselves. And I must admit, I have my last test of Firefly. I probably need to test it again because now it's embedded in all the tools, basically. Or not all of them, but a lot of the Adobe tools. I didn't find it to be that great, but they are doing a very interesting job in the source material. It's all from their creator-created image libraries that they own rights to and pay rights back to the creators. Exactly know what the split is like. It could be comparable to physically released music and streaming music. Maybe the artists don't do as well, but I guess you have to say it's better than nothing. I don't know. And how they are also trying to remove a lot of the rubbish that gets in there too. And so they've taken a very different approach and it seems to be paying off. I would argue because they have embedded the Firefly very well into the tools. It's probably actually what has made Firefly very successful is it's very easy to use it in all the, in a lot of the existing tools. You can now select things in Photoshop, in Illustrator, generate, jump through a bunch of suggestions, and then it's an asset you can mess with. Like something like that in Illustrator is amazing because you can get a base design to work with and then carry on from there. And I've had mixed success with it, but still it's there. You have it available for no extra cost. So yeah, I just found it interesting to see that it is being successful, and it's being successful for them in other ways as well, because they're saying that in the web app, which I am guessing has a free access or a login only, you don't have to be a Creative Cloud member, is 90% of its users are actually new customers. So it's also driving business to them. And Adobe, I think, is a really interesting example of a company. I think I've mentioned this a few times, who are managing to actually grow and evolve quite a lot in the past couple of years. Some of their tools feel like they've somewhat sat still, but some of the others, Premiere, Photoshop, Illustrator, are moving very quickly with a lot of AI tools. Now, maybe I should have included this with the programming video, but it seemed to work there. A little bit of computing history. First one is from 512 Pixels, the Apple Jonathan, a very 1980s concept computer that never shipped. Some of the pictures, which are renders, are quite cool. This like modular computer that some engineers in Apple proposed that let you sort of bolt on these different bits and pieces. They look kind of cool, but it does look like you've got like a little mainframe on your desk. So, I don't know what the size of this is. I have a pretty large desk. Some of the things I'm seeing, like the speakers, drive bays, the CPU, different sorts of CPUs. There's an audio system. Like, it looks pretty big. And then you have this, you know, for the time, this monitor sat on top that is probably quite small. It looks odd. It looks interesting, but yeah, I shudder to think the size, the noise, the power, the heat, something like this would throw out. But it's cool to look at. I'd never heard of it before. So it was news to me and interesting. In a similar way, this was over on the IEEE Spectrum, the rise and fall of 3M's floppy disk. Not strictly the rise and fall of the floppy disk, but 3M's business in it and how they kind of sold it on, and how, you know, one of the companies that were basically one of the biggest names behind floppy disks in the first place moved away from it. And they, mostly because they were a company that were never really into consumer devices and somehow kind of got pulled into it and found that it wasn't really their business selling things like floppy disks. And some are still around, strangely. Here's a quote actually from the article. In January of this year, Japan announced it will no longer require floppy disk copies of government submissions. But 3M actually got out of the business 28 years ago, which shows you how long floppy disks have been around for. Anyway, it's an interesting story. Actually, the original magnetic storage is nearly 100 years old. In 1928, an Austro-German engineer from BASF, which is another company in a similar sort of business to 3M. And that is about it from my links for the episode. So what's news from me? Well, I am kind of back catching up on quite a lot of things. I have a lot of blogs in progress, but I actually have some new videos, and some of the blogs are based on these videos, actually. What have I got up? I have an interview and demo with Servos, which I did a little while ago, and is now up. Servos is a kind of tool, open source and commercial tool for implementing application roles and permissions very easily in your applications. Quite cool, quite interesting. And then I have a very different video playing with a sort of novelty AI app called Dreamface. You could see me having some fun and some nonsense there. I have a book out. My tech writing book is now out. It is called Technical Writing for Software Developers. It's available on Amazon and from Pact Publishers. And it seems to be selling reasonably well at the moment. I think it's too early to have any reviews or anything like that. But it seems to be selling fairly well, according to Amazon. Anyway, it's number one on Amazon in technical writing. But I'll take it. And yeah, it's doing all right. So head on over to any good bookstore and grab a copy if you so wish. And I am now working on two new books under provisional titles. I am working on the Ableton 12, quite different. So Ableton, the music software made here in Berlin, the Ableton 12 cookbook, and the working title Sustainable Full Stack. Both have contracts signed and work is in progress. They'll be out later this year. I think that is it for now. I will have some more blogs very soon and some other things, but those are the main things for now. I have been Christian Schiller. You can always find more about me at christianschiller.com, where you can also find how to get in touch with me. And I'd love to hear from you. Always nice to have some comments, some feedback, some reviews. Share the episode, share the show. Always welcome. Thank you very much for joining me. And take care, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the show. Find out more about me at chrischinchilla.com, where you can find show notes, sign up for my newsletter, and find all of my writing, games, work, and video links. There's also details on how to get in touch with me. And if you want to get even closer to what I do, join my Discord server for behind-the-scenes discussions and helping me produce my shows and work.